Yeah, so this is a title that was given to me for this talk. here you see some organizations that fund me. It's my turn. Just a quick outline. I just want to start by saying that I'm very lucky that my talk is after Sylvie's, because she gave the best possible introduction to my talk, as you will see later. I'll give a short introduction about SDB stars, the hot subdoors, since some of you may not know what kind of stars these are, and why these stars are important and very interesting if you want to study diffusion. And I'll talk a little bit about the methodology that we use to study diffusion in stellar models and in seismic computations. And then I'll finish with mentioning some processes that are actually competing with diffusions, which is mass loss or some kind of mixing. So the SDB stars are, from the evolutionary point of view, extreme horizontal branch stars. You see them here in the HR diagram. They are helium-burning stars surrounded with a very thin hydrogen envelope. And the hydrogen envelope is so thin that it's inert and radiative. And that's actually why diffusion is very efficient in the envelopes. And they are very hot and compact, which makes them also good candidates for gravitational settling and radiative levitation. Well, I can talk a long time about the formation scenarios, but I don't have the time to do that. Just want to say that it's not very clear how they are formed, but somehow they must have lost a lot of mass near the tip of the White Giant branch. And binary interaction has likely something to do with that. So effects of diffusion in these stars are, we have direct and indirect evidence for that. Indirect evidence is the fact that they pulsate, because as Stefan Chapinas wrote, if you have solar metallicity in the outer envelope, you wouldn't drive the oscillations. But if you assume a diffusive equilibrium profile of iron in the envelope, actually you have an opacity mechanism working in the iron opacity bump. And that can drive both pressure modes and G modes in these stars. The P mode pulsators are somewhat hotter, and the G modes are somewhat cooler. And the P modes have short periods in order of minutes, and the G modes long periods in order of hours. Direct evidence of abundance of diffusion is, are the abundance anomalies. The SDB stars are typically helium deficient, and they have lighter metals than iron are normally depleted, and some heavier metals than iron, such as nickels, are. Can be enriched by orders of magnitude, but actually, if you use diffusion theory alone, it would predict much more exaggerated abundance anomalies that is are observed. So you have in these stars actually a process that is competing with diffusion, because if you do the diffusion calculations, you will see that almost all the helium will be depleted in 10,000 years, which is 0.01% of the SDB lifetime. So we shouldn't be seeing any helium at all. And while this average value is observed. So what are the processes that are actually competing with diffusion? Like I said, that can be mass loss or turbulence, but there's no consensus on that yet. And I hope I can shed more light on that. Another effect of diffusion, which is interesting for astrophysicology, is that, well, you have a very steep helium to hydrogen transition zone in the envelope. And that is cause of mode trapping, similar as in white dwarfs. But if you incorporate diffusion during the extreme horizontal branch evolution, which is of a time scale of 10 to the 8 years, you see that actually diffusion is operating on this time scale and makes the helium and hydrogen transition more broad. So the mode trapping is likely to be less significant due to diffusion. Here I should show you some computations of the buoyancy frequency and mode trapping. So this is at the zero age horizontal branch after 10 to the 7 years, halfway through the SDB lifetime, end of the SDB lifetime. And if you look at the point of sight frequency, you can see a very sharp peak here, which is the peak caused by the steep chemical transition of helium to hydrogen, because at the start of the evolution, diffusion has not worked yet, and the transition is steep. And you see here mode trapping due to this steep gradient. I also show the red line, which are from observations by Reed et al. That tend to indicate that there's not fission mode trapping, but I'm not going to talk about that further. But what we see is that if we go doing the evolution, this peak in the point size frequency gets less peakier because of the transition gets broader, so you have less efficient mode trapping. But you see a secondary peak coming up near the core, which is actually the CO transition. So due to helium burning, you have a convective core, and near the edge of the convective core, you get a chemical gradient. And so from this plot to there, you can see the mode trapping is less severe, but you see a secondary effect coming up. And actually, the secondary effect of the core gets more dominant near the end of the evolution because the envelope doesn't cause any mode trapping anymore. So that's quite interesting because the chemical gradient near the core should be sensitive to semi-convection, and this could be a way to study that if, yeah. So that's interesting. I want to explain a bit about the methodology we use to study diffusion in our stellar models. Well, it's the basic picture that has been discussed this morning. You have a 1D hydrostatic stellar evolution code. In our case, that's the Eggleton code. You compute your equilibrium model, and then you apply a position code that gives you the eigenfrequencies and eigenfunctions. In our case, that's the non-adiabatic code MAD by Marc-Antoine Dupré. That's kind of the basic scheme. But if you want to do diffusion, you have to add in some physics and some extra ingredients. In our case, we use the opacity project data. I'll tell you more about that a bit later. But it gives you, for example, the relative accelerations and the opacities, which you need to get your diffusion velocities. And we used, I've shown a black box here, but I'll explain that black box. It's actually the diffusion routine by Antoul that we use to get the diffusion velocities. And the diffusion velocities go into your stellar evolution code because they tell you how the chemical transport is in your star. So this part I can actually kind of skip because Sylvia already explained a lot of that. Just want to mention that so diffusion is a transport process. So you start in principle with the Boltzmann transport equation, which gives you the time evolution of the distribution functions, which is the probability of a certain particle to have a certain velocity and place. And this equation is actually very hard to solve, or may indeed be impossible. But you can get approximate solutions by two very nice theories. That's the Chapman-Enskog theory that Sylvie already talked about, and the Burgers theory. So the Chapman-Enskog theory is simpler because it just gives you the diffusion velocity in this formula. But it has its drawbacks in the fact that that's kind of assuming trace elements because you're computing your diffusion velocities against a background of dominant species, which is normally protons. So you get diffusion, so you're actually assuming kind of a binary mixture, which if you compute the diffusion velocity of helium, this is the velocity of helium with respect to protons, and then you get the velocity of protons by local mass conservation. So this equation is simple, and you can use it if you have a dominant species. But like I said, the SDB stars are helium-burning stars, so they have a helium-rich core. This actually also have a CO inner core, and it has a hydrogen envelope. So there's not really one dominant species in the SDB stars, so we cannot really use this one simple formula. So we use Burgers theory, which is more convenient for multi-component fluid. And all the elements are treated equally, even the electrons. This is the set of equations that comes from the Burgers theory. I just want to say you can solve this. and we solve this with the routine that Antoul developed. You can rewrite this equation in a matrix equation. And we made some adjustment in the tool routine. We put in relative accelerations in that spot up there. And we use partial ionization and screen Coulomb resistance coefficients derived from screen Coulomb potential as given by Paquette et al. So that should give you some accurate diffusion velocities in principle. Let's talk a little bit about how you get your relative acceleration. Sylvia already showed some formula that looked like this, which is in principle the same. So you have to, so the sigma here are the monochromatic opacities. If you want to do diffusion in your star, your chemical composition is changing during the evolution and throughout the star. So you cannot use table-based data for that, because you have to adjust for each mixture that you can get. And so you have to do this integration. So the F is the number fractions of your elements. You have to do this integration, compare actually doing your stellar evolution. And we do that at each mesh point and each time step. So it's a very computing expensive thing to do. And you could instead use the Alessian and LeBlanc approximation, but maybe that's less accurate, I don't know. But in any case, Alessian and LeBlanc didn't go to the regime of temperatures of the SDB, so we couldn't use that. Let me see. So in principle, people use either a monochromatic data from Opal or OP. We chose to use OP because we knew that from the work of Jeffrey and Sayo that that gives a better consistency with the instability strips of the SDB stars. And also, they have codes available for easy computation of relative accelerations, so that helps. I show you the relative accelerations throughout the star. This is the surface of the star that's going towards the sentinel log max fraction of a few interesting elements. The most interesting here are iron and nickel. Pay attention to that one. And you see here the gravity throughout the star. Like Sylvie said, whenever your relative acceleration is larger than your gravity, you expect accumulation, or you expect those elements to levitate. And whenever the relative acceleration is lower than the gravity, you expect those elements to sink. So this is a typical SDB model, typical values, effective temperature, and envelope mass. And we can already, from this simple figure, see we expect iron and nickel to accumulate, and we expect the lighter metals to sink. And we ran an evolution series with that, with the Eggleton code, and this is the results. And indeed, that's true. You see, most light metals, they just sink near the surface. So the color scheme gives the H on the horizontal, extreme horizontal range. And you see a very big accumulation of iron and nickel coming up. And the interesting thing about this picture is that nickel is actually accumulating much more than people, nickel is actually accumulating much more than people thought, because it starts out with a much lower mass fraction, but because the relative acceleration are high, it actually accumulates to comparable mass fractions. And this has effect on the pulsations, because the opacity bump of nickel that lies a little bit deep in the star, so you can drive longer periods of pulsations. And if you do the computations of the pulsations during the evolution, this is the year in log scale. The red dots are unstable modes, the green dots are stable modes. Let's look at the upper panel first. We only did LS2 or lower modes. And we see excitation of, so the upper part here are the G modes, the longer periods. And we see excitation of G modes up to high effective temperature. And that was something that could not be achieved before without diffusion calculations. Well, I really have too little time. But what you also see is that, as I said before, helium is like dropping immediately. This is a number ratio of helium. And it drops below the observed value within 0.01% of the lifetime. So that's proof that there must be some process acting against diffusion that we haven't put in our models. So we start looking first to mass loss. You can get a simple estimate of how much mass loss you can have and still build enough iron to get enough iron reservoir to drive pulsations. And this is actually a very low limit. And we found, we used several mass loss rates. We found that mass loss has actually to be above, it has to be below 10 to the minus 15 solar mass a year. So it would not destroy the iron buildup. And if you have such a low mass loss, that's definitely not high enough to prevent the helium from sinking. So it seems that the helium abundance that's observed and pulsations that are observed are not compatible with each other within this mass loss scheme. So let's look at what mixing can do. We just first tried some simple parameterizations of the mixing coefficient, and not based on physics or whatever. But we see that for some, well, for some mixing coefficients, you can actually still get pulsations, and you can hold back the helium settling. So this gives us an idea that maybe turbulence could work. So what could then the physical cause for turbulence be? So there could be several things, rotational mixing, convective overshoot, but I'll try to explain a bit about Vilmar-Helin convection here. So there's some difficulty in which diffusion coefficient should you use for Vilmar-Helin mixing. We just started out by using Kippenhahn prescription, but we're including the effects of relative accelerations on the Vilmar-Helin mixing process and see if that gives you a different diffusion coefficient. And it does. And I'm not going to do the derivation, but the idea is that if you have a blob that's moving into another region, the blob has a different composition, a different temperature, a different density perhaps even. And that means that the relative accelerations in the blob are different than outside the blob. So you have an effect of gravity in the blob that's different than outside of the blob. And that was not taken into account if you derive the Kippenhahn coefficient. But if you do take that into account and then follow the whole Kippenhahn scheme, you get a slightly adjusted diffusion coefficient, which is the upper formula. And it's exactly the same as Kippenhahn, except of the factors B and A there. Well, this doesn't tell you much what it physically means, but if we just plot those coefficients, just for this model that has some iron and nickel buildup, we plotted the mu gradient, which is the black line. And whenever you have a positive mu gradient, you should have efficient Vilmar-Helin mixing. So according to Kippenhahn, you would have mixing in this region. But if you look at the red dot, which is our adjusted diffusion coefficients, we see you don't have mixing in this region, and you have some mixing in regions that you wouldn't have mixing according to Kippenhahn. Why is that? That's because if you have regions where you have a layer that experiences more relative force outwards than the layer above, you can get an instability even if you don't have an inverse mu gradient. And otherwise, if you have a blob that's like pushed more outwards than the layer under it, you can have stable, it can be stable even if it has an inverse mu gradient. So that's the idea. We just show here some simulations of doing the evolution with different diffusion coefficients. This one doesn't have Vilmar-Helin mixing. This is the Kippenhahn. This is the Kippenhahn with G relative acceleration adjusted. And the colors are again times. And you see if you use Kippenhahn, you get efficient mixing after 10 to the 6 or 7 years. And it becomes flat. And you don't drive any pulsations anymore. But if you use the G-Rod adjusted coefficient, the buildup is not prohibited, and you can still drive your pulsations. So it has a big impact, at least for the SDB stars. So I just want to conclude with saying that diffusion is definitely very important in SDB models, should be included during the evolution, and the effects on the pulsations should be taken into account. And also can give you some strong constraints on processes we poorly know, like mass loss and turbulence in these stars. Thank you.
Thanks much. Any questions and discussion now? A little bit of time here.
Just a short comment. Iron opacity bump, so-called, is not composed only of iron and nickel, but there are other elements which might be important.
Yeah.
I think that chromium and manganese is worth considering.
Yeah, they should actually also be considered, and we haven't done that so far.
They contribute at slightly higher temperatures, so they change the range of temperatures at which
higher
pulsations.
Manganese
contributes to slightly higher temperature to the bump. So this will change the range of temperatures at which stars are driven.
Yeah.
So that might be interesting to include.
of doing the computations, and it just, yeah, we haven't done that yet. But.
The way you included this diffusion and analyzed was that trying to understand if it helps excitation or not, or you also try to figure out how it can affect the frequencies, or?
Well, it affects the frequencies in the sense that it affects your stellar equilibrium model, because with the high opacities, the star gets more expanded. So in that sense, it does affect your frequencies. But at this point, we are just looking at mode excitation, because I'm not sure if, yeah. So that's what we did in this study.
Do you have kind of exercise with observable for diffusion in STDs?
Well, like I said, in terms of the surface abundances, we have some constraints. And the fact that they pulsate means that they should have some iron and nickel accumulation.
Yeah, but I mean, to constrain the efficiencies.
Well, yeah, it's not a...
We're broadcasting, so if we have questions, they really should be on the mic. So
yeah. Okay, I'll repeat. I mean, in a sense that you would be able to constrain the efficiencies of diffusion, etc., by comparing your model with diffusion or without diffusion with observation.
Well, if you don't have diffusion, you don't get pulsation modes excited. I mean, we know that these stars pulsate, so in that sense, we know that diffusion should be operating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of questions, actually. You said you got instabilities when you had, because of the radiation pushing upwards.
Yeah.
Bubbles. Is that the kind of thing that Ed talked about, like a fluidized bed instability?
Yeah,
many years ago, before you were born, I'm sure.
Yeah, the photon bubbles, you mean.
Yeah, that's
right.
I didn't
hear about that until just now, so
it
could be the same thing.
Very interesting. I've been intrigued by that for a long time.
But I should look up the Spiegel work, but I didn't know enough about that. Yeah.
The second thing that's very interesting was your results on the effect of the sharp feature in the buoyancy frequency.
Yeah.
That was not seen in the observations. Do you have any idea what's going on there?
Well, there's also some controversy whether actually the observations are not missing some trap modes. Maybe you see quite constant periodization, but maybe you're missing the ones that are trapped. You're not sure about that yet.
Okay.
So maybe it's too early to use that as a constraint on your models.
So maybe we'll hear more about that later in the week, I hope.
Yeah, if observers can really tell me these are the period spaces and we are sure about that, you can use that to constrain your model.
Well, you can't see the radial order, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you can take the period, divide by the period spacing, and get an estimate of the radial order.
Well,
it's good to an order of magnitude.
Awesome.
We're theorists here, right?
One quick question here. On the SDB MOS stars, actually one interesting physical thing is if you go to a more typical core helium burning star, your initial conditions wash away because the hydrogen burning shell just readjusts itself to the local burning. But in these stars, you really don't have that. So your initial profile sort of gets mapped onto the structure of the SDB star. Have you looked at that to see if there's the way you construct your starting model has an impact on these things?
We did that in an artificial way by having a zero-age horizontal branch models and playing with a profile of the shape of the hydrogen profile to see, and that actually has an effect. But very soon the diffusion acts in, and then it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Since we have
a little time, could you comment on how to make these stars?
You mean numerically or in real life?
Pardon?
Numerically or in real life?
Well, both. In real life, preferably.
So the main formation scenarios are, in principle, you have a common envelope phase where a companion spirals in a red giant, and the common envelope gets ejected because of the heat and friction, and you end up with a compact binary. You could also have stable Rochlub overflow, and you have a white binary, and that also should happen on the red giant phase. Or you could have two white dwarfs merging and then igniting helium. but and that should give you STBs with very thin hydrogen envelopes. So these are the basic ideas, but...
And there's no way to make them as from a single star?
Well, there has been scenarios, but it's difficult. It has to do with the mass loss that you have to experience near helium flash, and that's unknown, what the physics behind that should be.
Yeah.
But, okay.
All right, great. Well, thanks very much.
Our next speaker, Pascal Girard, will be telling us about double diffusive convection, not merely semi-convection in stellar interiors. So, thanks much.